Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
Oh, hey, little guy, what's your name?
Double.
My name is Eric, and I'm joined by Michael. It's Michael.
Hey, guys, it's Michael.
Isn't that great? It's Michael. Look who's shown up for all of the movies in this entire run of shows. Guys, yep. Congratulations. We have all completed perhaps the most ambitious and overly complicated thing that we have ever done, which is this strange journey of year 12.
We're doing a journey this year where we're trying to figure out who has a more of a hand on the wheel when you're creating a film. And we've decided to take a look at a specific screenwriter and a specific cinematographer, David Mamet on the left and Roger Deakins on the right. And one of the reasons that this became very complicated and has reached this complicated point is that David Mamet eventually just started directing the shit he wrote.
Yeah.
So That's tricky, but I think that today we're doing Red Belt, which he directed and wrote, but we have five films of various writing projects of his that will help us inform what of this comes from script and what of this comes from direction. And then we're doing, and this is also very difficult, we're doing Blade Runner 2049 for the Roger Deakins. And this is difficult for a few reasons. One, because it's probably the most ambitious of the Deakins movies we've covered visually.
Yeah.
So he's got a big playground here. However, he's also, the movie itself is being helmed by Denis Villeneuve, who is an incredibly visual and visionary director.
Yeah.
On our show, he did Enemy, he did Prisoners. He's doing Dune, presuming nothing changes in the planet.
What could change?
What could possibly change?
His name. His name could change. I'm going to go with his Canadian pronunciation, Denis, today. How do you feel about that?
Ooh. Oh, yeah, whatever.
Yeah,
see how long you remember.
Yeah, okay.
So those are the two movies today. Those are the two people we're looking at. And we're going to have to also bring with us the baggage of Blade Runner, LOL, smiley face, double feature, Blade Runner, haha.
Which we started off the year so that we could sort of include this as a listener pick.
I think it was Aaron Shore, if I'm not mistaken.
It's Aaron Shore.
I'm confident Aaron Shore left us with Blade Runner 2049 and Ghostbusters 2016. I think those were the options he gave us.
Yeah, so if nothing else, you have gotten really good at explaining the journey itself. But, you know, we're a very Arturo heavy show. We're very director-centric. And we just, film is a giant collaborative medium. It's what makes it so much different than so many other artistic endeavors. And we wanted to really look at two other loud voices in the room. And what made this even more complicated to me is, as we talked about last time on the show,
previously on Double Feature,
let's do this one more with feeling, The Untouchables and The Lady Killers, American Buffalo and The Company Men, The Verdict and Doubt, and most recently, the wild, wild show Vanya on 42nd Street and The Village.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time we got there, we were really going, okay, yeah, Mamet, let's deconstruct the fuck out of what a film even means. What does it even mean to write something? There's 10,000 writers on a project. They all wrote things 10 to 100 years apart somewhere in Russia, you know. So we really, I mean, deconstructed is probably the right word. We just deconstructed the fuck out of what, it almost became an existential idea. What do all these layers mean? How can we tell just by watching a film whose voice does what? And the short answer was you sort of can't, but here's a way that we can choose to look at this. And then, you know, The Village was just, it's Deakins, but doing a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got to talk about some things we know about in the visual tool bag for horror movies. So Red Belt is finally going to land this mammoth plane for us.
Mm-hmm.
But not as easy as we could have gone, because it's also of the mammoth movies. I mean, we had, let's talk about the mammoth directed movies we're not going to do.
Mm-hmm.
House of Games, Homicide, State and Main, Heist, The Spanish Prisoner. There are a lot of big, very mammoth-y, very well-known of his films, and we're probably doing one of the more obscure mammoth-directed movies. So we're not going to let ourselves off the hook too easily.
Right, right.
But we are going to try and go, okay, we got pretty weird last time. Let's end here on the mammoth. And man, you said everything that needs to be said about Blade Runner. It's fucking Blade Runner. I don't know what else you... There's going to be some big voices in that room.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we've laid it down accurately. Let's start on what the hell is Red Belt?
Yeah, I mean, what the hell is Red Belt, I think, is a really good question, because one of the things that we have sort of established with mammoth scripts is this sort of procedural nature of cause and effect that is very matter of fact. There's not a lot of, it's not a very floral style.
Mm.
And
seems to cut things that are superfluous.
Yeah. And you get a movie like Red Belt, which here's one of the things that I think, it's funny because it's a summation of something that you don't summarize, which is, I feel like a mammoth script is difficult to pitch.
Oh, hell yeah.
If you go, what happens in Red Belt, you have to explain the entire plot of Red Belt.
Yes.
You can't go, dojo teacher is training a guy, and third sentence. It's like fucking... Yeah. It's like fucking, okay, listen, it's really complicated. So there's this guy, and he, you know, and I feel like that is still having cut out all that superfluous shit. This is an hour and 41 minutes of succinct storytelling.
Yeah, yeah.
A different filmmaker, this would be, I can say this because he's not on the fucking show, but if this were a Scorsese movie, this is 4 hours.
Yeah.
David Mamet does it in a buck 40.
Yeah.
And it feels rushed. I mean, like by the end of the movie, I'm like, whoa, really?
Yeah, a lot happens because it is beat after beat after beat of there's an idea that we've probably talked about a million times in film. It's a very simple and often cited idea. Show, don't tell.
Right.
And that is, it's not a mantra that Mamet sticks to, certainly in this movie. This is a movie that could just as well be a play. It is dialogue focused, and the dialogue drives forward the plot. We're not spending a lot of time getting to know people. We're certainly not hanging out. We are there to figure out who they are, see what is causing conflict immediately in their world, and just keep moving.
Which I think is crazy for a movie about fighting.
yeah, isn't that?
You know what I mean?
Well, that's why I felt like we had to bring it up, because it's Mamet, you know, it would be Mamet directing action, but there's kind of like one action scene in it.
Yeah.
Now, it is completely dialogueless when they get there, which is kind of a cool thing to go, you know, here's this mammoth. And not to say that mammoth's all about dialogue, but really even once the fight starts, we basically know what happens. You know, we're getting caught up in doing the scene, but even the fight itself rings different than most of the rest of the movie, because I don't feel like there are beats to the fight, so to speak, mm-hmm. that are going to push forward or turn or twist the plot in any ways. Once he starts fighting people to get to the center of the ring to say the thing, that's basically the trajectory we're on. And so it's interesting for somebody who does not really, and I don't know that we can find a good example in, you know, now that we've done all of these movies, I mean, The Verdict, American Buffalo, The Untouchables, they all keep driving. And occasionally a director will take a second to show not tell or to veer off somewhere or do a thing. But when Mamet's at the helm, it's really only during that bit of action that we take a stop down.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny because I don't even, you know, even as I sort of said, once we start the action, we know what the conclusion is. I don't know if that's true because there are even kind of twists in the action. He's fighting off different people. He's trying to make it towards the front of the ring, but he's basically trying to blow the lid wide open on this. You're right. You can't even summarize on the stuff in the movie, on the entire hour and 40 minutes of experience that he's had. And he goes to tell somebody and he can't get to him. And that is mid-fight. And so he fights some more. He fights in another direction. And by the end of the fight, it kind of becomes about a little bit different of a thing. We don't even see him, you know, the mic lowers, but it doesn't end on him delivering a message about corruption or anything. It ends with a hug. I mean, it is even kind of a twist in that. So maybe that does stay very true to Mamet the whole time. But it's a funny thing to think about him directing and to see that you really get to see what's important to him. You know, you get to see, we have all of these actors, we're focusing on character. And I feel like even in a movie that could take some time to venture off and do other things with fights or with action, we stick there with the characters. It's funny to know that in Mamet's eyes, he thinks he's doing Kurosawa here. That's really what right. He sort of feels like. Mm-hmm. You know, he's talked about how this is a samurai film, how it's a Kurosawa inspired film. And then you want a wild double feature, you put this against the Kurosawa film and kind of see the delta between them. And I think that tells you a lot. Basically, in the end, tells us what we already know, which is Mamet focuses on the page. And, you know, it's a lot like, I think when we get, a lot of times we'll see an actor direct a film. The film is very acting centric. Rarely do we see
lots of close-ups. Yeah,
I'm very hard pressed to think of an actor who directed a film and it was a total visual arts.
Right,
it looks like Blade Runner. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like compare the two movies we're doing, Red Belt and Blade Runner. I mean, it's a completely different type of. It's a fucking whiplash of a double feature to do. You know, for that reason.
And I think too, one of the things that's really challenging and I'm not even talking about in our exploration of David Mamet, I'm talking about this movie as a fucking whole, is like, it's just so dense, dude. It's just such a dense movie. I mean, it doesn't waste time. It doesn't, it's funny because you mention films directed by actors. And I feel like there is and I don't mean this in a negative way, but there's just so little regard for the humans on the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
They're fucking pawns in this story that move the plot along, that turn the fucking page. But like I mean this as somebody who comes from the big Chiwetel Ejiofor is one of the greatest actors of our generation camp. Like he's kinda in this movie, but he is on the screen the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to say he's doing a bad job, it's just that the film doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't care if he's selling it, because the movie's going to go, there's a plot, man, and it has an ending, and that's where the movie's going to go, and that's sort of, it just feels like a fucking bus route.
Are you surprised then by the fact we're talking about a writer here? And one of the very first things you noticed, and you know, I did too, is that this is a hard movie to pitch.
Yeah.
It seems weird, right? It seems like a writer, the first thing you're going to have is, look, here's what I'm doing. And I wonder, look, I don't have a good answer for that. But I think that is different than the other Mamet movies we've done. American Buffalo, you might as well just, you know, say it's about a nickel and shrug afterwards. I mean, you could really make the most minimalistic arguments about summaries of each of these. The Verdict is another one that seems very easy to summarize. But I also wonder if by 2008, Mamet has made enough movies and is such a well-known force that he just felt like he could do, oh, I'm doing a boxing movie, an MMA movie, a jiu-jitsu movie, and just kind of have people go with him.
I mean, it definitely feels like this is sort of a movie that he wouldn't not direct. It seems like the kind of movie where if you were to write this and you somehow got a studio just on your pitch and your script to go, yeah, we're going to do this, that he would still be in that room and be like, I have to direct it. Nobody's going to fucking understand what this is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I feel like a movie like Red Belt is so uniquely David Mamet that if you put another person behind the steering wheel, you will lose the bulk of what we ended up knowing as Red Belt. I feel like you'd see more fighting. I feel like there would be way more of a classic cinematic relationship for all the romances. It probably would have been cast dramatically different. And I think that the heartbeat of the movie would have really been lost if it was handled by somebody who was ready to make blockbuster cinema.
It is a tricky thing because you have so many points in the production of a movie that you have to get people to buy in that, I mean, I understand the impulse to go, you know, a log line constrains my creativity and I want to write a movie that it's not that, you know, all of the plot threads in here, all of the character development and surely this fucking cast, like they take care of the stuff. The movie is mm-hmm. what the movie is about. It's just that it is a little hard to explain to people. And if you can get to the point where they're going to read the script, I think a lot of these actors would go, wow, there's a lot of character stuff for me to do here. So this is very interesting. But I don't know if we've ever totally addressed this on the show. And I don't want to, again, just to try and keep things accessible, I think. A lot of people probably already know this, but there's an idea of a log line to a script, a log line to a movie, or to really any piece of fiction, which is a simple pitch for what the movie is. Now, we could look at Red Belt and go, well, this is a movie about principles, people adhering to their principles. But it's not quite a theme. A log line is more like the way I've always heard it, which no longer probably even applies to society, is like the TV Guide channel pitch.
Okay.
It's a sentence that tells you what the movie is.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't probably know what the fuck a TV Guide, but it, you know, when you go on Netflix, it's the one sentence thing.
Right. The one sentence thing that I'm trying to read while the fucking trailer starts screaming at me. Oh, and I'm like, stop spoiling it. I just want to know what's going on.
Oh, Michael Kester, you can go in the settings now and shut that fucking thing off.
I know, but it just keeps coming back.
Well, so, you know, typically a log line includes who the dude is, who this movie's about,
mm-hmm.
what their goal is, and why the movie's not over in 5 seconds. You know? I should probably do a better job at this. It's the protagonist,
mm-hmm.
their ambition, and the antagonist or the opposing force, the obstacle.
Yeah.
And as long as you have those things in gear, your fiction works. Now, it's a little bit of a work, and sometimes you just want to make a movie about what the movie's about and try to give me a log line to a fucking David Lynch film. You know, I mean, not every artistically satisfying work of art needs this, but it does become very helpful when you have to go talk to even Chiwetel Ejiofor and say, hey, I got a movie for you. Here's what the movie's about. And so to your point, and you know, there's a lot to be said about log lines. I mean, it can get a little more complicated than that. There's a way to write a good one. There are adjectives you want to work in about your characters. But without getting too down in the weeds and like screenwriting 101 stuff, the idea is to convey your film, your protagonist, their goal, and what they're pushing up against in a phrase. I have trouble doing that with Red Belt.
Mm-hmm.
Because one, it's not just about some dude. It's about a bunch of characters. And you can cheat, you know, in your log line. You don't have to, rarely when you read a one sentence description of a film, does the film offer nothing more than that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But even if we go, okay, well, let's just tell people it's about this one guy and he has this jiu-jitsu, what would you call it, a clinic or a dojo, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he has a dojo, he's a very principled guy and they're having money troubles. And so somewhere in there, maybe the money troubles are the obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
But man, I feel like that's very far from what happens. And then when you really, if you really want to write a true log line, maybe you look at something like an inciting incident. What happens early in the movie that sets all of this whole wild adventure ablaze here? And it's a woman coming in and accidentally shooting out a window. Mm-hmm. In like sort of a weird tussle that doesn't make sense.
Right.
And then
peace. Well,
but that's
still not really the beginning of it. The beginning of it is a woman can't find directions to the pharmacy.
Right, right. But if we're trying to simplify here, not finding directions to the pharmacy, we never really revisit that. we never come back and figure out where that pharmacy is.
In this
at.
Film, a woman can't find directions to the pharmacy. When she meets a principal dojo owner who is hard up for money.
Yeah. Which, and you know, the other funny thing about it is he spends all of this time kind of resisting. I really feel like if you want to be true, if we want to not lie in our log line and just go, it's about a principal dojo owner and he has to overcome his bills or what the fuck ever. If we want to not lie about it, the obstacle is actually his principles.
Mm-hmm.
The obstacle is how many times he has a way out of his financial troubles and kind of just won't take them because he doesn't believe in those routes. And so, you know, even that makes it kind of tricky. So, all right, we get the movie off the ground. You manage to write it without the guide of having this sort of log line.
Mm-hmm.
You manage to pitch it to people. You manage to get people on board. But really, even when the movie's done and you have proof that your idea was in there and worked, without having that kind of log line, it also becomes difficult just to explain to the audience what they're going to see here. And I think this is something that's, you know, let's just add one little wrinkle to David Mamet before we get away too clean here. I think this is something Mamet kind of sees coming because he leans really hard into like, let's bring on, okay, it's character driven. It's going to be all hard hitting actors. A lot of TV mm-hmm. people, a lot of people you see in his other work. But I mean, point to a fucking person you don't recognize in this movie. It's crazy.
Right.
So it's kind of an ensemble cast and that for, you know, in the indie world, but it's people you associate with theater, with heavy acting stuff, people who are doing Vanya in their spare time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you couple that with people from kind of the MMA world, people who authentically know about this. And so now you have a movie that speaks intelligently to the thing that it's about. It's trying to go, hey, this is a jiu-jitsu movie. And if you're interested in a jiu-jitsu movie, in a movie about any kind of, I'm sure people are writing emails, but any kind of fighting or sparring or arena sports or the theater of that, we're trying to talk about that in an authentic way, bringing in people who are actually from that background. And so he makes a couple strikes back, even in the marketability of this film, in finding kind of a narrative thrust to that marketing and figuring out, okay, how am I, in the end, the question is, how do I get people to go see Red Belt? Who's going to watch mm-hmm. it? Like, what is it? What is the movie about? And so, man, this is a pretty, it's a pretty weird final piece to look at, but in a way, it feels very fitting because I don't think we should go through an entire thing talking about a screenwriter and never really land on the most basic fundamental part of what they do, which is who's this movie about and what are they doing in the movie and why isn't it over in the first scene? Then we compare that to Blade Runner, our Deakins movie, Blade Runner 2049.
Right.
And all you got to do in Blade Runner is be like, oh, you remember Blade Runner? Yeah, it's Blade Runner 2.
Right.
Logline, we don't even have to mention it here because it's existing IP.
So I think what's interesting going into Blade Runner 2049, looking at Roger Deakins, is it wasn't until we did The Village that I think you and I really started to be able to go, what does Deakins bring to a film other than putting the vision onto the celluloid?
Yeah.
And it wasn't until The Village where we started to see actual inventive work that maybe he was bringing to the table. His hands in the proverbial pot.
Yeah.
And now, and I think there's another film that we're not covering on this journey that just came out last year, but Deakins, maybe it was a slow burn in his abilities. Maybe it was a matter of him becoming so synonymous with cinematography that people threw gobs of money at his abilities. Mm. But Blade Runner 2049, in my opinion, as a Denis Villeneuve fan, is a Roger Deakins movie.
Denis, it's still Denis. See, I remember. Old Denis Villeneuve. I think you're talking about 1917, right?
Yes.
The other. Yeah. And 1917, I don't want to, gimmick isn't the right word, but it's got kind of a thing it's doing.
Sure.
I actually think this is such a good culmination of the work we've done in this journey so far because, man, this is the most stylized film of Deakins' career and maybe one of the most stylized films ever made. It certainly doesn't have one thing that it's going to do, but in some ways that makes 1917 a little bit more of a experiment or an offshoot you can really circle that thing and go, here's a thing we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And Blade Runner 2049 is, let's put a massive amount of money, which means manpower and equipment and sort of unlimited creativity in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Not every way, but in a lot of ways. Let's give Deakins more resources than ever before. And yet there is no clear thing to circle to be like, oh, well, the thing about Blade Runner is it's in black and white. Or the thing about Blade Runner is, any number of things. It's just a highly stylized, every frame a painting kind of movie. And it has so much, at the same time, so much kind of baggage in our journey. Because, we've talked about these other Denis Villeneuve movies, which are artistic forces themselves. But let's look at this fucking cast for a second. I mean, when we want to consider who the voice behind a movie, we have so many players that are Philip K. Dick lingers large out there. Ridley Scott lingers large out there. These, without even really being directly, on screen in any way. But Gosling,
right?
Harrison Ford, Robin Wright, especially at this time, and Batista at this time. I mean, I feel like every person, Ana de Armas and Mackenzie Davis, even just in the smaller parts of this movie, so many contenders for, one way to sell a movie is be like, hey, this is a movie with Harrison Ford. That's the movie. Do you want to see it? Oh, have you seen that new Ryan Gosling movie? Nobody's going, yeah, what is it? It's just like, oh yeah, that.
Tell me what happens.
Oh, what's the thing of the movie?
Right.
That's, well, on the one hand, you have to
go, Chiwetel Ejiofor, he plays this dojo owner who's really principled. And on the other hand, you go, and Ryan Gosling drives a car.
Yeah, and that's enough. And so you have all these forces, and we haven't even mentioned Jared Leto, who is one of the...
is a force to get me to not watch something. Let's be real fucking honest.
Jared Leto might be one of the few forces whose personality has more of a cult following than even the film Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's just, you put Jared Leto in a movie and it is, it's, you know, it, it's like the way we used to talk about putting Crispin Glover in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it, that movie is a lot different the day before he's cast than the day after. That stuff is just, I don't have to explain why Jared Leto is Jared Leto, but look, as soon as he pops up in a scene, that scene is different.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as we cut to something and now we're in a room with Jared Leto, we're doing something here. And it might be a lot different than what we were doing in the scene before. So all of that's contending, and this is already in a movie where on our journey, and I guess my point here, is that it's been a little hard to see the Deacons. And so now finally we land here and we have some of the loudest possible people in the room, and you still feel like, ah, but I see the Deacons.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. I mean, I not only do I feel like I see it, I feel like when I go back and think about Blade Runner 2049, I've just watched it, but before I rewatched it, you know, I was going, okay, so Blade Runner 2049, we're coming at this, we're thinking Roger Deakins. But before I put it on, I was like, I don't really remember like the plot. I know like he kind of goes and there's like replicants and he like goes and finds Deckard. But man, I just remember, I could paint from memory scenes.
Oh yeah.
Of this movie. You know what I mean? I don't know what happens. I don't remember who people play. I don't remember what role Jared Leto had in the movie, but I definitely remember how scenes looked and colorization and where the composition weighs the frame.
Mm-hmm.
And just shit that I don't remember about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, and also something that largely, just to talk about our dynamic, has never really been something that you and I spend a lot of time
right
talking about. Like when we film stuff, you write it and I compose the frame. you know, it's just, you're not the kind of person who's like, oh yeah, Blade Runner 2049, I remember that because of these lighting setups or whatever sort
right
of, you know, because right of visual imagery. And so it is, I think you are our anecdotal evidence straight out of the gate. But I mean, I totally agree with you. I think this is where we finally bring land the deaconship, I think,
mm-hmm,
is if you weren't convinced that this guy is a force this whole time, we're watching these movies and you're talking about him like, oh yeah, he's kind of a chameleon. And we're talking about it. This is a little hard to do. You know, we know about choices Deacon's making, but we don't know his work the second we see it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get here with Blade Runner 2049, which I had seen before. We know this is coming. You know, this was intentionally planned on the journey, but we get here. And finally, I do feel like we go, look, a lot of people are bringing their A game. This is the sequel to Blade Runner. It's kind of an important movie. A lot of people are bringing their A game, and the loudest A game seems to be the Deacons. Mm-hmm. You know, it really does. It's
mm-hmm.
These are all just opinions, guys. I don't know. I just said this is the most stylized film of all time earlier, so whatever. These are just opinions. But look, man, I mean, I feel the same way you do. I remember them sitting in the weird reflecting pool and casting all of these crazy lights. I remember him getting out of the car on what looks like Mars.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, you know, just scene after scene after scene of these, framing is one, you know, composition's one, the sort of fixation they have on these geometric shapes,
mm-hmm,
and the way it feels like you could sketch out a quick, even being a person who doesn't, doesn't draw. You know, you could sketch out these sort of crude storyboards of what's going on. All of the scenes in the sort of library or whatever, wherever that fucking weird...
Mm-hmm.
I just remember that desk that's like a subterranean, you know, long strip window. And at the same time, all of it seems to pay tribute to the original Blade Runner.
Right.
Which is mm-hmm. crazy because that's such a visionary movie and in a different but the same world.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the biggest things that blows my mind. Yeah, okay, so we talk about all these other people involved in this movie, but Blade Runner is already it's already a feeling. It's already a, you know, it feels like it could be, if I had shown up on a project 10 years ago and gone, here's what we're doing today. We're making Blade Runner. You guys seen Blade Runner? We're going to do that kind of thing. Everyone would go off to work and know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody who's seen Blade Runner doesn't know which neon to hit where and to make it rain, and it's in Los Angeles, but everyone speaks Chinese. We get what to do. And yet somehow we're still bringing all of this new vision and all of these new ideas. It's kind of crazy that a movie like this even exists, that a project like this even exists.
Right.
Especially coming out recently, it's like, something else we haven't really talked about on this show is how science fiction like this doesn't really happen anymore.
Well, dude, I mean, listen, science fiction went through the same ringer that, and fuck you if you disagree with me, because I know I'm right on this. Sci-fi went through the same fucking ringer as horror is going through right now.
You think so?
There was this wonderful moment of what we now refer to as classic sci-fi, which were the epics. Sort of not including Star Wars, but during Star Wars. You know, Blade Runner is a literally prime example.
Mm.
And sort of around that time, maybe just a few years later, we saw horror doing the same thing. We saw the real horror epics. And I'm not talking about Child's Play. I'm talking about The Shining. I'm talking about The Exorcist. I'm talking about Carrie and Psycho. And these movies that when horror was on the map the first time, and now then sci-fi kind of mellowed and became small and digestible because those weren't going into cinemas at the same capacity. And so you had to do Primer and you had to do, to check Denis Villeneuve again, you had to do Arrival if you wanted to do anything. And these were human stories with science elements, but they were not sci-fi epics.
Yeah.
And horror's doing that now. That's what horror is now. If you want to see a horror movie in a theater, it's a fucking Ari, what's his name?
Aster, yeah.
Yeah, it's an Ari Aster movie. It's a thinker with like horror elements. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I fucking love The Lighthouse. I think The Witch is honestly one of the torch-carrying films that turned horror in this direction. But the epic nature is gone because people are more invested in the human elements of a story, and people aren't necessarily looking for world building in cinema. I mean, they're not looking for shit in cinema because of everything is delayed till 2038, but
right.
Till 2049.
Come on, easy. But I mean, I would go as far, we've come a long way on this journey, so maybe we get to cheat here and just, this is a thing that I want to continue picking out with you because I think I'm a little more dire about it. I would go as far as to say I'm not sure sci-fi, I want to say something really hyperbolic and I know everybody will just check me on it immediately. What I want to say internally is that sci-fi doesn't exist anymore.
Right, which is wrong.
That's not true. But the kind of science fiction that we used to have, not to say it's just about world building, but when we were really all the way up to the throes of kind of doing things like Total Recall, all these Philip K. Dick type movies or Minority Report. A lot of it was Philip K. Dick, but man, I feel like the 90s had a fuck ton of sci-fi. We had sci-fi through the Matrix. We were doing internet sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last 10 years, these movies have been truly crowded out. And I feel like we could count the number of science fiction films, just films you would call sci-fi, making no bones about, you know, how they, if they build a world or if they're a rival. Movies like Arrival, Her, Ex Machina, Upgrade, you know, that's about all we have for sci-fi.
I disagree. I just think you're ignoring the ones that we don't like. I think you're ignoring Oblivion, Edge of Tomorrow, Transcendence, Lucy.
No, I mean, I guess a couple, you know, of those.
There's basically a divergence in large scale, shitty sci-fi movies and small scale quality sci-fi movies. And I mean, I'm saying that in quotations, because I don't necessarily want to knock, you know, Edge of Tomorrow or Transcendence or Oblivion or any. I'm not knocking them, but they don't carry, they're not two-fisting. The movie I always go back to when I think about quality sci-fi, when I'm trying to really grasp at a movie that shouldn't exist nor be as good as it is fucking Silent Running.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember Silent Running?
Oh, yeah.
Bruce Dern is a gardener in space.
Right.
And then Marilyn Manson did that spiritual remake on that song.
I'm sorry, what?
And that movie is essentially, it's this small scale movie that tackles these huge ideas.
Like all 70s style.
Sci-fi. Sure,
those
but then
the
we
most
got to
easy like elevator pitch movies.
But then we got to Blade Runner, which was this massive scale film that tackles really complex ideas, and it sort of converged there. And after that, you kind of just went, do we want to do big budget Tom Cruise sci-fi, or do we want to do think pieces on the implications of aliens forcing the planet to unite?
Well, the thing we're ignoring here, this is probably a bigger conversation for another time. I mean, but
absolutely it is. Clearly, because this is a Deakins show.
I know, but I'm just so stuck on this. Well, the reason I came around to this at all is just to say that Blade Runner's mere existence is already pretty monumental for all these other things. Blade Runner 2049's existence. But on top of that we don't make movies like this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
People can look at this for themselves, but, you know, go on your favorite list of movies, whatever site, and just do a sort for sci-fi films of the last 10 years. And what you're going to find is you got to click down 10 pages to even find a Tom Cruise Edge of Tomorrow sci-fi.
Nah, I bet you Edge of Tomorrow's in the top 10.
Well, you're forgetting about all those movies where people in weird suits fly around and shoot beams at each other. Those are the top 200 sci-fi movies.
You're right.
This is what I didn't want to make this another big fucking thing, but look, sci-fi movies got crowded out by comic book movies. That's just what happened.
Sure.
And, you know, Blade Runner 2049, when it came out, was a big, like, look at this huge effort. It costs all this money. Oh no, people aren't going to see it. But it is from kind of a bygone era. And I think more of a miracle than most films, especially of this size, are that all films are a miracle that they get done and come out. But this movie, especially, an entity like this doesn't really make a lot of sense today. Nobody's really doing it. And it's just kind of fucking crazy that we get to see this playground, that we get to even have this for Deakins.
Mm-hmm.
We get to see this playground. We get to see a lot of this stuff we've talked about, you know, the way it's amazing to look. There's so much writing and different behind the scenes videos and stuff you can watch because this was such a big movie. But a lot of the questions about Deakins we had trouble with was because in order to answer these, sometimes you just sort of had to be on set. You have to see him and Denis talk to each other to figure out, like, okay, this giant thing that we've all identified, is that a Denis thing or is that a Deakins thing? And so you can see these guys hash out some of these problems on a lot of this great material that's out there. But, you know, the VFX videos, strangely, were some of the ones that really got me, because when you look at other movies of this size, you know, some of the superhero ones, when you look at behind the scenes VFX shots, what you always see is that Robert Downey Jr. is shouting at a tennis ball and there's a bunch of people running around with shields made of green in green suits. Everything is just green, and they paint the entire fucking movie in. And while the point of some of these Blade Runner VFX shots are to show you like what they did, a lot of it's already there.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the look of it's already there. None of the VFX before and afters I've seen for this movie change the look of what's there. They extend sets. They make bigger things a little bigger. They clean stuff up or erase it or whatever. But fundamentally, that look was there on the day, which is pretty fucking impressive for a movie like this. So much comes to lighting, which is a thing we can hardly even talk about on the show because you sort of need a visual,
mm-hmm.
visual medium to like really get into it. But some of these lighting rigs are crazy elaborate. A big thing in looking at the Deakins interviews was this idea of never compromising performance. And so that also seems counter. This fits right in with what we've talked about with Deakins. He's about, you know, always trusting the director's vision and going back to the director's vision, something that we've assumed from watching these other movies, and not interrupting the acting or compromising the performance. When you get Deakins on the set, you don't get, oh, this means our actors are only going to be able to move from this space to this space and have to look exactly right here because we have Sir Roger Deakins and we need this to look exactly like he wants. So he spends a lot of time crafting these elaborate rigs so that people can feel like they are in the world of Blade Runner and they can move around like they're in the world of Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I can add my anecdotal bit to this too, I find of maybe any of the members on a film crew, the DP can be the most potentially problematic just because of the nature of their work, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have a lot of money in a, you know, an indie film. And so you light it to get a really good look out of it. And what that does is constrain everything else you can do because you don't want people to move too much or do too much of a thing. So, you know, there is sort of a cliche about certain DPs being prima donnas. And my experience has sort of been like the bigger ones you work with or you know, when you get to see movies that have higher and higher names of DPs, they tend to be more like, look, we're going to do whatever that guy says. He's obviously super famous and talented. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, only look up and to the left and never anywhere else for the duration of the scene. All right. That's way more than anybody asked for, but whatever. Here we are at the finale of this. I want to thank the executive producers. They have made this show possible. Let's thank once again Aaron Shore?
Oh, yeah, Aaron Shore.
Abbot of Unreason, Brett Hayton, Charles Crawford, John, and Tom Leonard. You can sign up to the Patreon, get the whole back catalog where we do other weird journeys. That is patreon.com/double feature.
Movies, next time. We're going to do this quick because we are already running very long. Turns out we just have a lot to say about... This always happens when we don't think we're going to have a lot to say. So next week... Who knows? I feel like I already have a lot to say. So next week we're going to do something. I don't even want to go into the theme. Please, 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 if you have never watched Movies for Double Feature before, next week is the first time to start for real. We're going to do a movie called Sorry to Bother You. We're going to pair that with an older film called Bullworth. If you've seen either, watch both again. And if you've never seen either... You won't understand them if you don't watch them. This isn't a read the synopsis situation. This isn't a I get the idea. I've seen the trailer. These movies are loaded. And honestly, this is our fucking job. But honestly, this pair is going to put both of these films in a place that is just going to elevate them to exactly, honestly, what we fucking need right now. So... Once again, Sorry to Bother You and Bullworth. Next time on Double Feature, watch more fucking film. Bye.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.